Hi, and welcome to the Irish American Political Show. I'm your host, Gina London. And in this special series, we set out to explore and examine through the eyes of the Irish American voter what's being described as the most divisive presidential race in U.S. history. And in this special episode, we have Judd Legum. He's a lawyer, activist, campaign researcher for Hillary Clinton's first presidential bid, and most recently, the editor of the online political newsletter, Popular Information. Judd, it is fantastic to welcome you to this program. The day that we are recording this right now live is the day that many of us woke up or went to bed with the news that President Trump and his wife Melania have both tested positive for COVID. So I think I'd be remiss to jump into anything else before we talk potentially and explore what does this mean for the campaign?
Well, I think very practically it means that President Trump, who's been fairly active holding large rallies in key states all around the country, is going to have to curtail that activity. He had an event scheduled for Florida that's already been canceled just a few hours after we got the news. I think the other issue is where it steers the conversation. Trump very clearly does not want to talk about his response to the coronavirus. He'd rather talk about violence in cities, or the Supreme Court justice that he just nominated, or really anything else. But I think the fact that he has now himself contracted COVID-19, it's going to center the discussion around that issue. So that's going to have a big impact because we're only a month away, just about from Election Day. People are already, many people in the United States are already voting either by mail or early. And we know at least two of those weeks he's going to be isolated in the White House.
Ripple effect for me, if you can. I know you're not the official tracker for COVID-19, but the people that have come in close contact with him, potentially even Joe Biden, although they didn't obviously embrace or shake hands when they were on the stage. And Joe Biden's wife, Jill, as you saw her come up on the stage afterwards, was still wearing a mask. And many on his side of that event of, I guess, the 70 people in the audience and his team were still wearing masks. And many of Trump's family apparently were not wearing masks, except for apparently Melania, but then she took it off to come up. Hope Hicks, people on Air Force One, people also back to the White House staff. As you mentioned, Amy Coney Barrett, he just met with her a couple of days ago in the Rose Garden, and now she's been going out and meeting with people in the Senate. How many people are going to be quarantined? Is there any speculation on how much of a quarantine shutdown are we going to be experiencing?
Well, I don't think we know yet, but one of the things that's been reported well before this is that President Trump and his staff has really resisted taking kind of the recommended precautions when you're in close proximity to people when you're in close proximity to other people who are not within your family. And the White House is actually a pretty confined space. It's pretty cramped. There's small hallways. The rooms are small for the most part. And they've been relying on the fact that they were getting daily testing. And so therefore, they didn't believe they had to do this. Now, the problem is they've been getting daily testing, but they've also been traveling around the country to these events where most of the people there are not masked. I think Trump kept his distance for the most part from those crowds, but his staff was not able to. So you have a situation where his staff is mingling with large groups of unmasked people all around the country, coming back to the White House and then in close proximity to the president, his staff, it can very quickly spread in these kinds of environments. So I think that the extent to which it spreaded within the White House staff could be very significant. I think all we know so far is that Hope Hicks, one of his top communications advisors, she tested positive first, actually, and that's, I think, why the president got tested, but it could be many more people. There already had been several. Robert O'Brien, his national security advisor, previously tested positive. So there's already been some folks who'd gotten it previously, but this could be much more widespread potentially.
Right. The inner circle was closing in. I think it was in May that his valet was tested positive and the vice president's press secretary was tested positive. And now, as you mentioned, I think it was on Wednesday, the day after the debate, Hope Hicks, who rode to and back from Cleveland for that debate, with the president on Air Force One was tested positive. And now, as we hear, the president himself, Donald Trump, and his wife, Melania, have both tested positive. And so that, as you said, that testing bubble that they were quite proud of has burst. Let's talk a little bit then, and of course, it's a developing story, and we can't predict in many different ways that it can roll out. And let's switch then for a moment about your own impact and what you're seeing and what you're hoping to achieve. Talk a little bit about what popular information is designed to do.
Well, it's really about accountability journalism. So I'm looking to really examine the promises and the public statements of all sorts of entities and people who are in power, whether politicians or corporations or anyone else, and then check that against what's actually going on. So one thing we've done, as there's been, for example, a lot of advocacy around racial justice in the United States following the murder of George Floyd and other unarmed African-Americans, that a lot of corporations have been speaking out publicly and saying, you know, we support this effort, Black Lives Matter. In my newsletter, I've been looking at their political contributions of those corporations and seeing if they match up with those stated public values. So that's an idea of what I'm trying to accomplish.
And what are you finding in that research for the corporate line versus the corporate donation?
Well, what I found was that many of the corporations who claim to be fully 100% committed to the Black Lives Matter movement and racial justice have given tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars to politicians that received a failing grade from the NAACP, which is the largest civil rights organization or the oldest civil rights organization in the United States. Many times these public statements aren't matching up with how they're spending their money politically.
And is that then impacting what you're seeing or what are you finding on the ground there in terms of the if there is polling, some of the early voting places, like Florida, for example, is one, and there are some voter registration numbers that are coming out in terms of who's coming. I think there's been a million already and more who voted in early voting, record numbers for this time, this many days before the actual election date. And of course, that's in large part because of the COVID and social distancing, and the requests for mail-in ballots are up. What are you finding about the voter turnout so far? And what are you finding in the wake of these types of issues that are driving that? And what are you also finding then about these perceptions or the continued allegations from Trump and others on his team that this system now is faulty, flawed, fraudulent, rigged, whatever it may be? What is it driving more turnout? Is there more confusion? What are you finding where you are?
Well, I think what we've seen is that the early voting turnout is high, much higher than it's been previously. Actually, in previous elections, many states didn't even really quite allow voting yet. So we don't really have an apples to apples comparison. Many more states have expanded their window, expanded mail-in voting to try to deal with the COVID-19 situation. And Fair. So we are seeing very elevated levels of voting this early on, a month before the election. I don't think we know how quite that translates into total overall turnout, because of course it depends on how many people decide to vote in person as well on election day. But I think the expectation is that participation overall will be quite high. We've seen that in some of the special elections and other elections, primary elections that we've seen in the lead up to this, even ones that have occurred during the pandemic. I think that Trump's rhetoric about the election being rigged is clearly an effort to try to dispirit and his opponents, to try to make them believe that this is not going to be a fair election and suppress voting. I don't think that is working yet. And again, this comes back to the diagnosis that we learned about just a few hours ago, where how does this impact his ability to continue stoking these fires? It's going to be hard for him to really drive the conversation that way while he's in the middle of this.
And while we wait to see what level of communication, and I suppose he can still tweet Judd from wherever he's quarantining. I think that's not going to be taken away from him. So we'll see how his communications are during these next 2 weeks. But in before that, I think we need to explore a little bit about the ongoing in calls that he's making along these lines of rigged and fraud and how it equates in with the Army for Trump, which is a website that you can go to and sign up and enlist is the word they use to fight the Democrats, another word they use, about coming to the polls, about standing there and watching the polls, and his call out to the Proud Boys. Now, apparently, last night from when we recorded this on Thursday night, he was on Fox News and did finally definitively say that he was condemning the Proud Boys and condemning the white supremacists. But that has not been his consistent rhetoric since he took office, and even on the night of the debate. And your information, your popular information newsletter online, has an article about this movement, the Proud Boys. What is going on where you are? I think especially listeners who are viewers who are watching from places outside of the U.S., it's hard to believe that there are these militias and there are these groups. And what are they, what you're hearing or seeing or listening to or speaking to, what are they potentially preparing to do? And how far do you think they will go during and as this election heats up?
Well, I think there's two kinds of issues. One is the issue that you refer to about poll watching. This is something that the Republican Party has actually been, by court order, prevented from doing for decades, because they historically have used poll watchers as a way to intimidate voters. The court finally dispensed with this consent agreement, and this is the first presidential election in a very long time where they're going to be able to do this. And so I think that has the potential to intimidate voters, suppress voting just by their presence, depending on how these folks conduct themselves. And clearly Trump is not preaching restraint as he discusses what you should do when you're a poll watcher.
So I think last week in Virginia there were reports and there were some video of these Trump supporters waving and marching, and some claimed that they were blocking entrances, and the legitimate poll workers there said, in the word you use, that they were feeling intimidated. So it seems that it is already underway.
Yes, I think that's correct. And then kind of a step beyond that are groups like the Proud Boys, which is really a street gang that's motivated by a whole wide variety of different sorts of bigotries and prejudices. And then they are fully prepared to use violence, and in fact want to use violence as part of their activities. And Trump kind of inciting them, telling them to stand by, telling them that someone needs to do something about the left is really quite dangerous. It has a very destabilizing effect. You are right that a couple of days later, he came back and said, finally, after being asked several times, I condemn the Proud Boys. But by this point, I think the Proud Boys themselves have received a very different message.
And yeah, they've already made their T-shirts that are quoting Trump in support of them.
Correct.
What are other things that you and the people that are putting together popular information, the people that you work with as an activist, what are they concerned about, or what are you looking toward over these next 30-some days?
Well, I think preserving the right of people to vote. It's not just about being feeling intimidated. There also are a lot of legal battles where the Republican National Committee is filing suit all over the country in different states, trying to limit the time period in which absentee ballots can be received, trying to put different restrictions on how the absentee ballot can be qualified with matching signatures and things of that nature. So there is a big legal battle that's going to play out both over the next 30 days, and then if it's a close election, potentially beyond the election, as they're trying to hash out which ballots are going to be counted. And I think that is a huge story over the next month. In addition to that, in addition to our presidential race, we also have control of Congress that's up in the air over these next 30 days. So there's lots of important races in different states that is going to determine whether or not Congress is going to be, which party is going to control Congress. So we're going to be looking really closely at a lot of those key states and issues that are going on in those key states.
For example, and talk about key states, we've got Pennsylvania was the big turnover state with 20 electoral college votes that went for Trump in 2016. And now I believe in the last poll that I saw anyway, Biden is still ahead with about 8% in that state. Is there any way without Pennsylvania that Trump does still carry the electoral college?
Theoretically, yes. Theoretically, there's a lot of different things that could happen, but you have to remember in 2016, he had a very narrow electoral college victory, which means he needed pretty much every state he got. And so once you start taking states off the board, like Pennsylvania, it becomes very difficult for him to win, especially since there's a lot of states like Arizona, like Georgia, North Carolina, states that he did win in 2016 that are trending very much towards Biden. It's going to be difficult. So he really does have to really maintain all the states he won and then hope to pick things up. He's behind now, and that's where this diagnosis comes in. How much time's running out? What's he going to be able to do in this last month if he's also recovering from the coronavirus?
Right. When we're recording this, it's the 2nd of October. The second presidential debate is tentatively or was scheduled anyway for October 15th, with his just before that 14-day deadline of quarantine. Will that actually be held? What will happen if he, forbid, became really ill with this? There are so many questions going right now, more than we even thought we had just on the heels of that chaotic and incoherent debate on Tuesday. And another question that I've heard, and I know it's been a few more hours for wake up time for us here in Dublin than it is for you in Maryland, but we are also hearing that if Amy Coney Barrett, the Supreme Court nominee that President Trump has put forward to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg, if she then needs to quarantine, if she gets tested and she needs to step down, that puts back those confirmation hearings that are being rushed through Senate. And of course, Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham are both some of those senators who's the chair of the Judiciary Committee, are some of those senators who are up for reelection. Is there a scenario that you can foresee or that you're hearing already in which she doesn't get confirmed before the actual election day?
Well, I think that was going to be very difficult. It was possible, but very difficult even before this situation, because typically the confirmation process actually lasts longer than 30 days. There's been a couple of times in history when it's been done in that time frame, but typically it's more like 60 days or 80 days or longer. So if you start taking out half of that, well, then there just won't be enough time, especially because in addition to the time constraints, they're going to need all the Republican senators to be in D.C. to do this. And many of them are, as I was mentioning before, are in competitive races and are not going to want to be in D.C. for this entire period of time. So I do think it is a scenario. There is a very possible scenario where they don't get to this vote prior to the election. Now, they would still have November to January in what's called the lame duck session, right, where they could potentially still vote her through.
It would be amazing to see if they were trying to push that through in a lame duck, in the lame duck session, as you describe, if they've actually lost through election the number of Republicans versus senators that would be coming in, that majority that they need to get that nominee across the line. Last question, what are the top 2-3 things that you would encourage or that you're looking for in this ever moving situation? Is it the continued protests? Is it the calls of the rigged and the fraudulent voting? Is it now the new thing on the landscape, his health? What is going on that is going to move this election, and how can you then make a prediction on the outcome if you'd like.
I'm going to pass on making a prediction on the outcome because I think we've all learned that one of the things I've learned in quite a few years in the United States politics is that things change very, very quickly.
And well, we're witnessing that now.
It's very hard to predict what's going to happen. I really think that the most important thing are these voting restrictions, because so much of the American public at this point has really decided whether they support Trump or not. There's very little that's going to happen over the next 30 days with the economy, with COVID, with anything else. It's going to change people's minds. So the question is, who turns out to vote, who gets to vote, who gets their vote counted? That's going to be the key issue that decides this election. And there's a lot that goes into that, with in-person voting, with mail-in voting, with early voting. And that's going to be the big fight, I think, over the next 30 days.
Judd Legum, so much to unpack and so little time, not just here on this program, but in those 30 days to the actual election day, and then potentially beyond as those votes continue to be counted, as you so said. It was a real pleasure speaking with you, the founder and the editor of the political newsletter Popular Information, among all the other accolades that you so rightly deserve. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm Gina London, and once again, that is this episode of the Irish American Politics Show, and please join us again next time as we look and get even closer to this election day.